So what we can do, we can either use fuzzing, and then at some point, once we realize that we don't get any new coverage by doing fuzzing, we can switch to this SMT solving of constraints, or we can use symbolic execution to see if we can, using an SMT solver, identify some inputs that would trigger this execution path we are not reaching with fuzzing. There are some branches that we are not exploring, and that's what we can use this constraint solving for, because it would help us generate the values that are necessary in order to analyze this execution path.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, GM, everyone. My name is Tagachi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with Polina. How's it going?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. And good. Yeah, thanks. How are you?
I'm quite good. Yeah, we've been talking for some time, trying to solve some problems, and we could probably address them here. So I'm quite interested to see how this plays out. And I'm sure people will be quite interested to listen to this as well. And just for the people that don't know who you are, what do you do and who are you?
Sure. So hi, everyone. I'm Polina. I currently work on formal verification tooling for smart contracts at Runtime Verification. I joined them quite recently, I guess in June. And before that, I worked on formal verification at the Protocol Engineering Core Unit of MakerDAO. And also I worked towards my PhD, which was also on various formal verification techniques for smart contracts and automated bug fixing. I have some experience working as a software developer in Web2 before all of this, but for the last 5 years or so, I think my whole professional activity revolved around smart contract verification. Outside of this work, I also at some point participated in a couple of Code Arena contests just to get some better exposure to security of smart contracts and auditing, because that's what we are trying to facilitate with formal methods. Now at Runtime Verification, I'm mostly focusing on improving the existing tooling, mostly symbolic execution, symbolic testing, and trying to make them more accessible to general audience and therefore more useful for the community in general.
Gotcha, yeah, interesting. And why did you choose formal verification over, let's say, something like fuzzing or dynamic analysis, I guess?
Honestly, I think it was largely by chance. I started working with blockchain in a slightly different setting. So my first research project was addressing scalability issues in private blockchains, like Hyperledger Fabric. I don't want to comment on the applicability of private blockchains in general. Then I met my supervisor, who I did my PhD with, and he basically told me all of about this, about program analysis, program verification. He was also very excited about analyzing smart contracts. So I actually owe quite a lot to him just for introducing me to smart contracts. It actually ended up, I guess, a very good career choice for me and a good research direction to work on. So it just sounded like a good way to address the security problem, which I was always very interested in and very concerned about. So formal verification provides you with the way to exhaustively analyze possible behaviors of a system, for example, of a program or a smart contract, which essentially provides you with this very good security guarantees, which are, you know, nice and important to have. So that was something I wanted to contribute to.
What kind of techniques do you really use in formal verification to leverage the power of it? First of all, what is formal verification and the benefits and cons of it? Just to give some context, then we'll go deeper into it.
Sure, right. So formal verification in general is the computer science technique or an act of proving that a particular system, be it a program or a smart contract, hardware or something else. So it's an act of proving that the system satisfies a particular specification. So a specification here usually is a set of properties, and every property is just a statement about what you want this software to be doing or not doing. So one example of a property is balance invariant. Balance invariant of a token saying that the sum of user balances should be equal to the total supply, which means that all tokens are accounted for, nothing was lost, and so on. You can define more specific properties. For example, if you approve some tokens, then, you know, the allowance variable, the change in the allowance variable is correct, or something like this. So you can just define these specifications on the function level, on the contract level. For example, invariant is a contract level property. Invariant is a property that you want to hold at all times. So formal verification helps you mathematically prove. Usually it involves some mathematical techniques. It helps you prove that this particular software satisfies a set of specifications that you have defined for it. A good thing about it is that it's, as I said, it's very extensive. So it's very exhaustive. Formal verification techniques aim to analyze all possible behaviors of this system, of all smart contracts, all possible execution paths, and so on and so forth. So if you have formally verified something, traditionally it is thought that you have like this very good security guarantees. If you have formally proved something to be true, then it is indeed true. That's what we want it to be. At the same time, and I have to say that I'm very excited about formal verification in general and as a field. I think significant progress has been done specifically with smart contract formal verification. And that's a very nice thing. It's a very interesting thing about crypto. So you can think all you want about crypto community and culture and things that sometimes happen, like not always the good ones. But at least in terms of formal verification, it actually fuels a lot of research and it funds a lot of research. So all the audits, all the tool development that is being done on smart contract formal verification is actually, I believe, in some cases with some companies, is relatively well funded just because there is demand for it. So that's something I really appreciate about working in crypto and Web3 in general. And apart from that, it's also a very responsive developer community when it comes to security. So it's very security aware for obvious reasons, right? Because every bug is very expensive and we know that for a fact. So I guess in general, people are more educated about verification, fuzzing, good security practices than I would assume them to be outside of crypto. At least that's my assumption. So that's something I really appreciate.
I was not into cybersecurity at all when I was a software dev, but you know, the more you go into kind of development, the more you learn about, I guess, testing techniques, etc. Especially, I think something like Foundry really emphasizes or like introduces fuzzing and variance, which I don't think anybody would really think of. If it was to build a program in like Python, are you going to fuzz test this, for example? I mean, you probably wouldn't even think of that. So I think the innovations of these large suites like Foundry really are kind of teaching everything in terms of software. And it was just kind of, you kind of saw it as like a wave as well. Like, oh my God, fuzzing. Oh my God, property testing, invariance. I mean, that's what I was like. I saw that kind of like thing pop up and I just thought, huh, what is this? I'd never heard of this. And then eventually I got into it. And I'm like, oh, wow, okay, cool. This is actually quite useful. But, you know, is symbolic execution a part of formal verification?
Yes. So sorry, going back to formal verification. Symbolic execution is one approach that belongs to this family of formal verification tools. So formal verification also probably belongs to this spectrum of program analysis techniques. And there is, I can probably start with some more lightweight, just to add some context. Probably the most lightweight, some static analysis tools, for example, Slicer. So what Slicer does, it just analyzes the code. It doesn't execute it. It just scans the code and tries to see if there are some issues according to some patterns, as far as I understand. So it identifies some patterns, then it reports that. Of course, it's somewhat limited in terms of what it can find. And it also generates a lot of false positives. So false positive is something that you identify as a vulnerability, but if you look into it, it turns out that it's not a vulnerability. Honestly, I think it's very useful. I don't see any reasons not to use Slicer. The results it generates are somewhat limited in terms of what it can detect. So they're just this inherently limited by the patterns that are, you know, encoded in the tool. So a slightly more comprehensive way to do the analysis is, for example, testing. So obviously unit testing is very important, should be part of every project, protocol, smart contract development. But unit testing only analyzes, for example, function calls with a particular concrete input, one concrete input, right? So if you have a function that takes a variable x as a parameter, and then you assume that in a unit test, you say, okay, x is going to be 5, and that's what you do in this unit test, well, that's all the results you get. And they are restricted to this particular inputs and the behaviors associated with it. I believe it's extremely efficient. So it helps uncover a lot of issues in the code. It might help at least, but as I said, so it's very limited in its capacities. So another way, step forward, is fuzzing that you have mentioned. Personally, I think it's great that fuzzing is, I think it's quite popular in the like crypto development community. So what fuzzing does, instead of running this code only on a single concrete input, it starts running it on a series of generated values. Like this, values are pseudo-randomly generated. So usually there are some heuristics. The values, so essentially it just tries to trigger some edge cases. By stress testing this function, fuzzing just hopes that, in some sense, you're hoping that these randomly generated values are going to identify some interesting cases, interesting execution paths, and you will end up in a state that, you know, exposes some vulnerability, something like this. So instead of executing this test, assuming that x is 5, it's just going to generate a set of values like 0, max, uint 256, some constants that I think fuzzer had found in the code, and so on and so forth. So just keep iterating over this possible values, aiming to identify some issues in the code. Fuzzing is extremely, extremely efficient. So I used it myself, I have heard people saying that they managed to identify some like findings in a auditing contests. I think fuzzing should be, so as same as with Slicer, I don't think there are any reasons not to use, at least for example, Foundry's fuzzer, since it's extremely usable. Another a good thing about it is that if you're looking at, for example, these fuzzing tests, usually you're trying to, sometimes, in some cases, you're trying to assert something. So it makes you think about properties you want to verify. Foundry also allows you to do this invariant testing, right? So that's essentially like stateful analysis, because if you define, as far as I understand, an invariant in Foundry, then it's going to analyze several possible sequences of function calls and determine if this invariant is still true. So doing this, I mean, like specifying some properties is a very important step of the development process, because it makes you think about how your protocol or your smart contract should work. And it's very good, like it's very useful to have this formalized. And once you have formalized it, sometimes you can determine yourself that the code actually doesn't match this specification that you wanted it to match. And yeah, so in general, it just makes you think about the system a bit more. So even if you don't do fuzzing after this, then I guess it's going to be useful. Anyway, if you do fuzzing, then of course, that's even better.
It kind of sounds like symbolic execution fuzzing are kind of similar in a way. It's plus a difference between the two in that sense.
Right. So the problem with fuzzing is that there is a chance that you will not generate these values that are going to trigger some vulnerable behaviors that are nevertheless existing in the smart contract. With symbolic execution, that is addressed by the fact that in symbolic execution, instead of running a program with specific inputs, even if they're randomly generated, instead of doing this, symbolic execution runs a program with so-called symbolic inputs. What it means is that the input parameter x in the function that we were considering before, this x is assumed to have symbolic value, which means that it can take arbitrary values. Like whatever an unsigned integer can be in EVM, that's what this value can be. And since it can be anything, it means that every conditional statement, like the first conditional statement that contains this variable we are going to encounter, can be true and false. So for example, if there is an if x is less than 10, then since x can be anything, we think, okay, it can be less than 10, it can be more than 10. That's, you know, let's analyze both execution path, both true branch and the false branch. So in this way, the goal of symbolic execution, in a sense, is to analyze all this possible execution path and determine if there is some bug there that, you know, can occur in one of this execution path, like a failed assert, some vulnerability happening there, something like this. So we're going through every of this execution path kind of simultaneously and trying to see if there is some vulnerable state that we can end up in any of this execution path.
Okay, yeah. And obviously, you want to limit the possibilities as much as possible, otherwise it's just going to run forever and you won't find anything, I guess. You know, if you have multiple parameters that are the maximum UN, so you want 2 by 6, so let's say you have 6 of them, or let's say like 4, I think that's a bit more realistic, but you know, you have all these possibilities of, you know, combinations of, let's say, parameter 1, parameter 2, parameter 3, parameter 4. It's matching every single bit in every single parameter, and that's the complexity. So you want to obviously limit that as much as possible. Otherwise, you just have this massive time complexity problem of, okay, let's combine parameter 1 and 2, every bit to every bit, basically, or every word possible to every other word in parameter 2 possible. And then you have to do that again for each parameter. So there must be some ways to obviously limit this, and that's with like constraints, right? You gotta know what is actually possible, like the ranges of these parameters. Maybe they just don't have ranges. And, you know, that comes to a point, for example, if there's no range specifically, maybe parameter 1 has to be less than parameter 2. And then it comes to a point where this is, you know, very improbable to solve automatically. What would be some like approaches to getting to that point of, okay, parameter 1 is actually less than parameter 2, but it also uses a storage slot in, let's say, parameter 1 has to be less than parameter 2 plus storage slot. That's when it would get insanely difficult to use, I guess, symbolic execution without knowing that relationship. So I guess, what are the approaches to getting to so that kind of relationship identification?
Right. So what you use for this is a so-called SMT solver. So what you do, if you have these four different parameters, we don't really consider the concrete values while we're doing the analysis. So we don't want to check every possible permutation, and we're not executing this concretely. So all the analysis is done statically. We don't really execute the code. We just, you know, emulate it in a sense, like simulate it in a certain environment where we are tracking these constraints, right, that we encounter. So what we usually have, for example, if you have several variables defined, you assume that the first, you assign symbolic values in a sense that, for example, you have two variables, x and y, and x is going to be alpha and y is going to be beta, for example. And then as you execute the code, you're just tracking the storage in memory in terms of these symbolic variables. For example, if you declare a variable c and you say c is equal to x, then you would also assume that c now became alpha. Then once you get to, for example, an assert statement, you want to check, which is going to say, for example, c, which is now alpha, is not equal to 5 and y is not equal to 2, something like this. So the vulnerability is going to be a failed assert, right? So if this assert is failing, that's something that shouldn't happen. Of course, it's a toy example and it doesn't make a lot of sense, but just as an illustration. So when we do symbolic execution, we get to this assert statement and we translate it to a logical representation that we can reason about. So it becomes alpha not equal 5 and beta not equal 2, right? And we want to see under what conditions can this be violated. So we take this logical formula that we have generated and we send it to SMT Solver. That is a piece of software, a very sophisticated one, really. So you can just treat it as a black box. What it does the actual solving. So it checks this formula, and based on the result of the analysis it performs, it's either going to tell us that there is no way this can become true, for example, if there are contradictory clauses. You cannot say, for example, alpha is equal to 2 and alpha is equal to 5. Like, that's not true. That can never become true, so it's just going to tell us it's not, like, it's unsatisfiable. That can never become true. If it is satisfiable, as in the illustration we have been discussing, then it's going to tell us that this can become true, like the violation of this assert can happen, for example, if alpha is 5, right? Because it was not supposed to be equal to 5. Or if beta is equal to 2, right? That would make it become true, which means that the assert is going to be violated and there is the issue we have identified. So in this sense, normally symbolic execution, at least in a way it is applied in smart contracts, is just usually used to identify this possible vulnerable states or just some scenarios where, for example, a particular exploit can happen or an assert can be violated. So a property can be violated. So instead of just tracking all these possible concrete values and all their possible permutations, we just add this abstraction over the variable, and then we just ask SMT Solver to provide us with the values that this variable should take in order for a certain problem to happen.
Interesting. Yeah. And I guess the limitations of obviously symbolic execution would be, you know, path explosion. And I guess one of the real solutions to this to begin with, which I think obvious path explosion is a problem of complexity and all the options, right? So the obvious solution is simplify it as much as possible. The only way you can really simplify it is finding the specific path. Well, it depends on the context and what you're trying to do, of course. But let's say in terms of finding bugs, right? You want to find the path that actually can potentially have the bug. Because sure, you can have all these potential paths. Some of them will be redundant, but you're just executing on this. And then you just have, you know, all these, you're just wasting computational power on them. Then you actually move on to the ones that have the bugs later on after, let's say, you know, you might have done like a week of just fuzzing or whatever, or anything of just like running it, right? But then you move on to it like a week later, and you're like, wow, I should have just like moved on to this first of all. So I guess one of the main points or main ways you can really limit path explosion with symbolic execution and identify the paths that actually are necessary to run, I guess.
Exactly. That's one of the ways to do this. So that is especially applicable if you're, for example, doing some vulnerability detection. So if you're looking for, I think it's called leaking ether, in one of the papers that I've read on this topic. So for example, you're wondering if the contract just gives away Ether to random users. So if you're looking into this, if you're trying to detect this vulnerability, then it only makes sense to analyze paths that include a call, right? Everything else doesn't really matter that much. It's a bit more complicated if we are trying to, you know, prove functional correctness of some smart contract that belongs to a DeFi protocol, because there are no, it might be hard to design what branches we should be ignoring, like what execution path we should be ignoring without compromising the completeness of this analysis. But in general, that's definitely one of the approaches. One other is there is a set of optimizations you can do on the SMT solver related aspect. For example, so SMT solver in general generates a large part of the scalability issues. In addition to state explosion, which you're absolutely right about, in addition to this state explosion problem, other scalability issues are just produced by the fact that these formulas that you're sending to the SMT solver actually might get quite complex and very large. And they might include a lot of things, for example, especially in smart contracts. If you are reading value from a storage and the location is symbolic, then you will have this catch-up value of this storage slot and index you're reading. And that's something you just carry with yourself in all these formulas that are sent into the SMT solver. And if you have a lot of conditionals, if you're asserting a lot of things at the same time and so on and so forth. So they get complicated. They get hard to reason about. So the SMT solver might either get stuck or timeout or something else might be happening. So that's also another problem with this formal verification tools. So there are ways to help an SMT solver. One thing that I think is being used in some of the existing tooling, you can just filter this query you are sending to the SMT solver a bit. So there is a good chance that some parts of this logical formula are irrelevant to what you're checking. So you can just drop them. There is a chance that that's going to make it better. You can try using a different SMT solver because there are several of them. There is Z3, I guess it's very popular. It's developed by Microsoft Research. It's very usable. It has a very nice Python interface. So if you want to start playing a bit with some of the SMT solvers, I guess this Python interface is probably a good choice. But there is CV5 for, so there are more of them, just to name a few. And they all have this common interface. So there is this format called SMTLib, which lets you write formulas in a way that all of the solvers understand. Like not all of them, but a lot of them. So you can try using them interchangeably and see if one of them actually performs better. Because they all are extremely sophisticated in a sense that they contain a lot of optimizations. They are very efficient in the reasoning that they do. But still, some of them might work better with, I guess, some of the types. And we have, for example, large bit factors in smart contracts, because that's how the sunside integers are usually represented if you're interacting with an SMT solver. So some solvers just might be better than others in solving some particular tasks. And I have seen this. So that might help as well, though it's not exactly an optimization. You can try improving the interaction with an SMT solver as well by doing some static analysis on top of the code you're analyzing. That's also one of the issues. So most of the tools that I have personally encountered perform the analysis on the bytecode level. And it's very reasonable because if you analyze source code level, if you analyze, for example, Solidity code, then it means that you also make this assumption that the compiler should be trusted. So you're not analyzing the code that's getting deployed. You're analyzing something in Solidity and you hope that it's going to compile into what you think it's going to compile. In that sense, bytecode level analysis, I guess, is more reasonable. It's EVM also is easier to reason about than Solidity. Solidity changes all the time. There are all these high-level concepts, constructs you should process probably properly, keep track of it. I was working on a symbolic execution tool for Solidity in my PhD, and it requires, it makes, you have to keep track of all these changes. There is Solidity versioning in it. EVM doesn't change that much, right? There are not so many changes.
I mean, it'd be like an introduction of any op code or like a deprecation of one. But yeah, like Solidity, it wouldn't really make sense to do Solidity because under the hood, I guess, it's very complex in the way you have to kind of record data structures, et cetera. Bytecode just makes, I don't think you should do anything but bytecode, to be honest.
Right.
Like a static analysis saying, oh, this variable was used here. I mean, you're doing the same thing, it's just harder, I think.
A lot of senses, yes. The upside of analyzing Solidity is that you have access to the information about, for example, where the function starts or that you're in a loop. Because if you're analyzing bytecode, so this information gets lost during compilation. This and some more high-level semantical information.
Just have selector and jumps that like kind of loop, but it's not like you have the abstract just for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So if you're analyzing bytecode, then you have to infer this information. And there are heuristics for that. So not the worst thing to do, but still, you have to determine if you're in a loop, because potentially you can end up in this infinite loop. And that's also one of the problems with like challenges that you encounter doing formal verification. What to do if you end up in this infinite loop? If the condition in the loop depends on, for example, symbolic value, and you assume that it can be anything, then you can just keep iterating over it infinitely, and you'll never finish the analysis. So it's not extremely useful. Usually, a common approach to handle this is to bound loops. So you're just making this assumption, and this also falls into this optimizations category. So that's how you limit the amount of states that you actually reason about, that you analyze. You say, okay, we're only going to be analyzing 5 iterations of each loop. That's it. That makes the situation a bit better on the front of, you know, you're not having infinite loops. You know that the analysis is going to terminate eventually. At the same time, you're also sacrificing the completeness of the analysis because you're not considering all the possible states, all the possible ways in which this code can be executed, which is, well, of course, is a downside. So there are some of these under approximations that you can apply in order to make symbolic execution and some other formal verification techniques more, you know, applicable and usable and make the analysis more tractable. So that is basically just, yes, restricting what we're analyzing by adding this additional constraints, which also translate into these assumptions we're making about this code, which might not necessarily hold, but that's just how you make them work.
Yeah, to find any bug, like a bug could be multifunction, right? And if you wanted to find this bug, for example, in like we're talking about the bytecode level as well, we're not looking at, I mean, even in Solidity, you can still have it. But like at the bytecode level, for example, you have a deposit function and you have a withdrawal function. They're both the same at the bytecode level in terms of, as you know, if you're increasing your balance of, let's say it's a mapping. So you're increasing the balance of that mapping by doing an S load to get the balance currently and then adding to that balance and then using an S store to store that new value into the, well, basically replacing it, right? So you're getting the old value, adding to increment and storing it. And then the withdrawer is getting the value, decreasing, and then storing. So in that way, it's kind of hard to distinguish. Well, obviously you can distinguish by, you know, increment and decrement, but then some of them would have, I don't know how, what it would be like, but maybe, for example, master shifts, like shares, for example, it would be, you know, total shares, the amount you've deposited, division, then multiply to get to like, you know, a value amount that's able to be withdrawn. And then, you know, then it gets quite difficult to reason about, okay, is this a deposit or a withdrawal? Actually, you know, it could be. It just depends on how really advanced or sophisticated some calculation is. And ultimately, is it being set to it? Because, okay, there's two different variations. There's one where it's, you know, get the value, get the storage load, then subtract, or storage load, then add. Or are you just getting an S store, which without the load, you just set it to that value. And at that point, you don't know if it's an increase or decrease. It depends on the inputs provided. And at that point, you know, what do you do? How do you really determine that at a bytecode level? It's like, oh, okay, it's just getting set. This could be anything, be plus or minus, which I guess you could build some heuristics for it, for, okay, this could be anything. So let's, you know, assign that to anything. For something that increases or decreases, you've got to set that to a positive or minus. So it's very limited. But the one where it's just an S store and I can modify it directly, well, it could be either a positive or minus. So I guess there is that kind of way determining that kind of stuff. But that whole function ordering stuff, it's like any bug is context specific, I think. For example, the Cream, actually, yeah, I guess the Cream Finance bug was context specific in terms of, you know, it used balance of, or total, like total supply, balance of, something like that, I can't remember, but it determined on, you know, context. And if there was a certain amount of tokens in it, then there was a new context. And obviously the exploit was the token balance was manipulated in a way where I think it was below what was already assumed to be. And so their value was actually, you know, a higher amount because relative to the total supply within the contract, I think something similar to that, it was, you know, very, very high because it was like a division thing. So like my account balance divided by the total supply. So obviously I can get more if there's less total supply. And then I think that was the thing, but yeah. And then that's obviously a context. So to get like the very advanced context, you need to do multi-function calls, and it's hard to identify which function calls are meant to be in what order which is ultimately how you find an exploit or a bug. So I guess what are some ways to really identify what order of functions should be in, what sequence?
Right. So in general, I would say that symbolic execution tools normally just try to analyze possible sequences of function calls up to a certain length. So for example, if there are three functions that can be called in your smart contract, external or public functions, then in the first round, it's going to symbolically execute each of these functions. If we have added up in some state that is considered vulnerable, then we have found this vulnerability, and that's where we probably stop. If we haven't found anything, which is more likely, then it just starts another round of this symbolic analysis. That is based on the results of the first round. So after we have symbolically executed every function call, then we are going to execute one more function call on top of the first one. So we'll get this possible permutations of these three different function calls up to length two. Then if we haven't identified anything at this point, then we just keep doing this at least until we have found something or until we run out of resources, which is very likely at this point. So the way to do this,
Would you run out of resources? Like when would you decide to stop, basically? Because I guess your resources would be, the gas within a transaction. But I guess in terms of, if you didn't find anything within, the first function and then a sequence of one function, sequence of two functions, and you have a sequence of three functions, what is stopping you from going to the fourth, fifth, sixth, for example? Like, I guess looping between functions that change states, like you could have like function A and function B, but then you're looping back to function A and function B, function A, function B. Like, what is stopping that? And even if that is the case, it might change the state in like a kind of ratio term instead of like static. So I guess what kind of would stop that instead of determining, I guess like when's the limit?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Mostly computational resources of the machine that you're running this analysis on. So you can do this. Usually this parameter, like the number of functions you're going to consider, is customizable. So you can provide it yourself. You can see what works better. The problem is with every added function call to this sequence, the number of states increases and the formulas get more complicated, they get larger and therefore more difficult to reason about for the SMT solver. So it increases the chance that the SMT solver is going to struggle and eventually will time out. So you will not necessarily get the results you're expecting from analyzing, for example, sequences of six function calls, especially if there are a lot of them. So you have to analyze a lot of these different permutations. As for how do we decide which functions we should be considering first, I guess so we can also rely on some heuristics here. For example, the one that you have been mentioning about, like we can focus on functions that are more interesting for us, which, for example, modify some variables that are related to potential exploit or that transfer tokens, something like this. I think a while ago, I saw a paper that was suggesting to infer the relation, like the relationship between functions in terms of their order. For example, withdraw without a deposit will revert. So you don't have to analyze sequences which start with withdraw. Like if this call just reverts, let's not consider this.
But then also, how do you determine whether it is a withdrawal or a deposit at like the bytecode level? Because obviously you just have the selectors and, the name can be anything really. It could just be like the letter A and that's your withdrawal. So at that point, you can't do selector matching. It would have to be some heuristics within the body, which, be like a plus equals or plus minus for withdrawal. But again, it could also be just the setter. So call data equals, value.
I think in this paper and in general, that's a common approach to do this. I think they have relied on some data analysis techniques. So you can you can statically analyze the code and then you see, I'm not sure, I have a feeling that it was on the source level, but I'm not sure about this. So basically, if you just see that this required statement is, for example, cannot be satisfied once, if you are starting with this function, then I guess you can just, use this information. You can also determine it's using symbolic execution, because whenever you encounter, there are different strategies for it. You can either collect all the constraints that you encounter in the execution path and then send it to the SMT solver, or you can, at every conditional statement that you encounter, like an if statement or for loop, every iteration of it, and so on, every time you encounter a condition, you send it to the SMT solver, and then you check if it's feasible. So what you can do, you just start analyzing this function. You send this to the SMT solver, it solves it, sunset. There you go. That means that there is no point considering this as the first function call in a sequence. But what I would say, honestly, about using symbolic execution and formal verification in general, so as excited as I am about it now, and I know a lot of work is being put on making it more accessible and more usable by different teams. At the moment, it has this inference scalability issues. So one good way of using it is to do some scoping. So I think that's what Trail of Bits. So I remember Jocelyn talking about it at some other podcast. He said that that's how they use Manticore. That's the symbolic execution tool that they were developing in Trail of Bits, probably are still developing. So what they did, they just applied it to a very specific places in the code base, which were tractable, but very important. For example, we can probably use it to verify specific functions in libraries, because these are very important pieces of code. It's important to know that they're secure and correct. They're going to be duplicated in a lot of code bases. So we want to know if, for example, a specific square root function, let's say, is correct. So that's something where we can apply symbolic execution, and there is a higher chance that it's going to provide us with some meaningful result. Because it's not a large code base, there are not a lot of states. It's restricted in terms of what it's doing. But analyzing this, verifying it formally, is going to provide us with security guarantees that would be otherwise unreachable if we just did fuzzing or any other, you know, sort of more concrete, more lightweight techniques. And one other application that I think I'm excited in that sense is we can also use this to do some equivalence checking. So since I have mentioned the libraries, right, we sometimes have different versions of the code, which is like some of these versions are just more highly optimized versions. And it's obviously it's harder to read bytecode, and that's how very optimized code usually looks like. So the thing we can do, we can use symbolic execution to assert and verify that the results of the function that we understand, that, for example, is written in Solidity, but it's less optimized, that the results are the same if we are running this highly optimized version.
Yeah, and another thing I was also thinking of was, you know, even if you do have this identifier of plus equals, you know, subtract equals. So, you know, the sload add store, sload subtract store, then you also have this possibility of, you know, you need a plus equals and a negative equals to set up another kind of state that requires a plus equal. Well, that allows you to withdraw, if that makes any sense. So, for example, if you have a good example is cream again, where, you know, you have this token that allows you to basically enter into another token. So you need to plus equals and then take, I mean, you need to get the token, so increment, and then it actually leaves your wallet, so decrements, to get another token. And then that token sets you up for another token, which eventually gets you to the point where you can manipulate the core total supply to withdraw everything. So maybe I'm like overthinking it, but it gets very, there is that also possibility, which is, you know, quite common as well. These big exploits is, you know, you get another token, then you actually use that token to set up something else, but it decrements the previous one. And maybe that at that point, what do you, if you're looking for just an increase in value, then yeah, I don't know. Yeah, this is quite hard to kind of think about this and then also speak about it.
Yeah, I know. I've been doing this for the last several years and it doesn't get much easier. What I can say on this is that generally what we are doing when we are doing this symbolic execution, we're mostly tracking the changes to specific variables in the storage, right? For example, you have some storage, you have some symbolic variables. If you're adding this symbolic value to some storage slot, that's what you're recording in this like mapping that you have defined. So you're saying that this particular slot now has this symbolic value. If you're then, for example, if you're subtracting 5 from it somewhere later in the code, the only thing you do in this case, you get this value that was in the symbolic storage mapping before, and you set -5. So you would just keep updating this. And then once you get to, for example, the end of the execution or some interesting place where you want to see if the assert is getting violated, for example, you just get this value from this mapping that you have recorded, like symbolic value -5 divided by 2, whatever else there was. And then you just insert it in the right place in the assert. So you just substitute this variable that should be stored in the storage slot with this value that you have gathered so far. Does it make sense?
You basically have a value and then put it in, you check the output of it, and then you just like replace the asserts. Wouldn't that be more like concolic execution though, instead of symbolic?
Oh, so concolic execution essentially is the combination of, well, concrete and symbolic. I think it's similar. Well, yeah, I guess that's quite obvious. I guess it's similar to what I think is being referred to as hybrid fuzzing.
Oh, is that like an intertwinable, like interexchangeable kind of word, like hybrid and concolic?
Honestly, I've been using them interchangeably. I'm sure there are cases where they both mean the same thing. Maybe there are some other concolic techniques that I'm not aware of. There is a chance that that's true, but in a lot of cases, they refer to very similar things.
Oh, okay. That's super not right. I've been thinking they're two different things this entire time. Because people use it in different context. Like they do like, oh, hybrid fuzzing, we use this technique and this technique. But then, yeah, I know it's kind of weird.
What did you think concolic execution is?
No, yeah, symbolic execution with concrete values. I mean, like, symbolic execution is also that, though. You're providing concrete values, though.
Well, some are concrete, some are symbolic. So usually symbolic values are input parameters because that's what you are not certain about. So for example, if you're symbolically executing a function deposit and there is an amount variable that is in like an input variable, then amount is usually symbolic. Then if you have some constants defined in the code, they're going to be concrete because that's what makes sense. And then when it comes to some other things, they can be either concrete or symbolic. For example, message sender can be concrete, can be symbolic. Environmental variables, block timestamp, block number. Normally, I guess they are symbolic most of the time, but you can also assume that they are concrete if you don't want to spend resources on this.
The way I think of it is they're both the same in the sense that, sure, you can provide the symbol for it, but you're providing still a concrete value in some way. I mean, unless the concrete value is always the same in every single run, but it's still a value. Oh, wait, I think I'm just going like super deep into it.
Well, in general, the only place where a symbolic variable becomes concrete is at this very end, when you ask the SMT solver if it can be true, like if a particular formula can be true. And it says yes, if the symbolic variable has this concrete value. That's the first time a symbolic variable becomes concrete.
Oh, okay. So if you know it works, basically.
Yeah. Once you just want to like make sure that it is indeed true. Before that, all the analysis is made without any concrete values.
So it's basically like,
for symbolic ones.
Sorry, but it's basically like you use symbolic execution to get the concrete values, which then you replace that symbolic value with the concrete, and then you continue on with symbolic variables, right?
That depends on the final goal. So in general, you don't have to plug it in back. If you're using symbolic execution to find vulnerabilities, then that's where you end. You execute it symbolically. It says like what concrete value you should be using in order to trigger this vulnerability. You can try this concretely, see if it works. If it's not a false positive, if it's like a true positive, which means that it's a real bug that we have uncovered, that's it. So in general, symbolic execution looks something like this.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I guess all the terms kind of make it for me, at least. I don't know like any of the terms realistically because they're all kind of confusing. I just know like
it is true.
Architecture instead.
Well, yeah, I mean, they are confusing for sure. And so symbolic execution, yeah, you can think of it as, you know, non-concrete execution. So we are not using concrete values. We are not running this code concretely. It's just static analysis in a sense that, you know, it's not concrete. We're not running it on the actual virtual machine. And concolic execution is just a combination of this with concrete testing. So I'm sure there is a way to combine it with concrete testing, which means that concolic and hybrid fuzzing are not entirely the same thing. But I haven't really encountered those. So I guess it's safe to assume that, you know, we can view hybrid fuzzing as one side of this. So what hybrid fuzzing, and that's actually something I'm extremely excited about because I think it should improve the performance of both symbolic execution and fuzzing as well. So what we can do, we can either use fuzzing and then at some point, once we realize that we don't get any new coverage, by doing fuzzing, we can switch to this SMT solving of constraints, or we can use symbolic execution to see if we can, using an SMT solver, identify some inputs that would trigger this execution path we are not reaching with fuzzing. So fuzzing is way more performant. So we are taking advantage of this performance until we find that we don't get complete coverage. There are some branches that we are not exploring. And that's what we can use this constraint solving for, because it would help us generate the values that are necessary in order to analyze this execution path. Or we can do it in the other way around. So we can symbolically execute the code. But there are some things that symbolic execution tools and SMT solvers in particular struggle with quite a lot. For example, hashing. And once we get to this point, for example, some constraint involving hashes or just some very complicated constraint, that we can't get through using the SMT solver, then we can try to fuzz through it just by, you know, using these concrete values that we can generate and see if that's going to help. So that's better than not being able to proceed.
Interesting.
I am aware of some hybrid fuzzers for smart contracts. I have seen some papers, but I'm not sure if they are open source.
And, you know, we mentioned generating secure contracts as well in kind of program synthesis. So kind of what is that?
Right. So that is, I think, an adjacent field to program verification. There are different sites to program synthesis. So one way to approach it that I have seen is the generation of contracts that are secure by design. I have seen a couple of papers that, for example, suggest that you can define a state machine model of a smart contract, and then you can theoretically or practically to some extent, you can have a tool that is going to generate the code. It would like follow this state machine that you have developed, but it also would make sure that it doesn't introduce vulnerabilities using particular techniques.
Forward engineering versus, I guess, reverse engineering for the bug finding.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how far ahead are we in doing this, but in general, I guess that would be something that would be very, very nice and very interesting to have, to be honest. I'm very interested in this like program synthesis problem in general.
Yeah, yeah. It's so super interesting. And it all combines into the same thing of everything kind of uses each other. And none of them are super easy to even, I guess, get right. It's all a bunch of trade-offs. What do you get from doing this technique over another one? And then can you combine all these techniques to kind of get the benefits of them all? Really quite difficult unless you, I mean, like, you don't understand the complexity of it until you get deep into the weeds, is what I found out.
Yeah, I think so. Well, one other thing that you can do with this is exploit generation. So it's also a form of program synthesis because you're trying to synthesize, well, the program that triggers an exploit. For example, when we do verification, we're also looking for a bug. And then in order to exploit it, we additionally need to, for example, synthesize a smart contract that go into perform this. So that also belongs to this pretty much the same problem of program synthesis. We need to basically automatically generate a compilable contract that is going to be contain all the things that should be there in a contract so that you can compile and deploy it. And it also should be calling these functions of a vulnerable contract in a way that does trigger the exploit. That is quite challenging. So one reason for that is that you should do bug finding first in order to be able to generate this exploit, and then you also have to synthesize this attack contract on top of this. But I have seen some work on this. And yeah, that's something I'm also quite excited about.
Yeah, I think it's super cool that you could just generate, you know, a path. I think all the tools now is really just identifying paths with no generation. So it'd be like, oh yeah, this is vulnerable here. That's it. And then there's nothing else. It just tells you where it is. But I think the formulation of contracts, you know, to actually prove that it works is probably like the coolest thing. Because it kind of feels like it's semi-automatic at that point. If you just find it, you're not doing anything with it, then it's, I mean, what's the point of it then?
Yeah, that's true. Plus, it's also like an automatically generated proof of concept, which I think would work too.
And, you know, if you're doing bug bounties, that's all they care about. If you can't prove it to the point where they can execute it, then you're not getting paid. That's the real kicker. And when, you know, white hats come across a bug, they have to explain it. If you don't have something that can, that's undeniably true, which is, okay, I can execute this. And you can do this with a simulation as well. If you just do like epoll to an RPC and you put in this contract and execute it, then it's a provable concept that they can just do one line command or just type in a sentence. And, you know, it shows you the amount in, amount out, the, you know, the money that is involved. And when you can provide that, it's undeniably true and you will get paid. Or they have this threat of losing money, and I'm sure they would rather just pay you to not lose that money.
Yeah, 100% agree. Plus, if you're using something like formal verification tools, then there is always a chance that what you're getting is a false positive, because using them efficiently does require a bit of over-approximation. So we might not, for example, especially when dealing with, let's say, hashes, which are hard to reason
about.
Oh
yeah, hashes are not.
Precisely. What you can do, you can just, you know, over-approximate it. You say, I don't care how exactly that works. I'm just assuming that I'm getting some value out of it and that different inputs produce different outputs. And that's how you get away with hashes in your smart contract. But what it means, and I personally got this once, I think I have found a false positive in the smart contract. It was like a hash collision problem, which was reported but wasn't there. And that was exactly because of this over-approximation that was happening there. So if you generate an exploit automatically, then it also helps you figure out if that's a false positive or if it's like worse reporting.
Yeah, this, in order to do a forward engineering thing that's secure, you would need to know where the bug is. So I think the generation of a contract is actually much harder than a generation of an exploit, because the generation of the contract requires the exploit to know what to avoid.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, in general, if you're generating an exploit, then what you have to do, you just have to call vulnerable smart contract, right? If you're generating a contract that should be correct by design from some representation, and you also want it, as you said, to be very secure and very correct and implement all security practices and avoid all possible issues, then yeah, of course, that's substantially more work.
Yeah, because you have to prove that it's actually an exploit. And then it would be an extra introduction of code, because you would say, okay, what conditions weren't met? Why was I able to enter this function? And then you would just add a conditional to kind of counter that. But of course, there needs to be some reasoning behind it. Otherwise, it's just going to ruin the whole kind of workflow. You might brick the system. Yeah, it's all interesting field. You can spend your whole career on this stuff as well. And I think it's important to recognize like AI as well. I think AI will definitely take over this in due time. But it's just, that's personally why I'm terrified of like doing this. At least, you know, I got to try and finish it before AI takes over, because it's inevitable. Like an AI is able to think in different dimensions to us, and our programs are only limited to our interpretation of, okay, what's a heuristic? What's a possibility here? What dimensions are involved? Whereas an AI can learn all that stuff. They can think in like insane dimensions and reason about them all, pattern matching, etc. So it's just a matter of time. But obviously, I don't know AI, and to learn AI takes years, right? To kind of get to that point of building a model. Is this model even good? First of all, do you have the data? It's, yeah. So I don't know, I guess building something heuristically that actually works in some regards would be great to train that model. So I guess it's a good pathway, a good stepping stone in some sense.
Yeah, I agree. With regards to AI, well, I would say that I think we're safe for a couple of years at least. from my experience with it, I would say that, as I said, AI is definitely probably unbeatable in pattern matching. For example, when it comes to just finding these common security vulnerabilities in smart contracts. So that's definitely something we can offload, that's for sure. So from what I have seen up to now, I'm not very convinced in the current abilities to reason of any basically AI-based tool. So I'm not sure. I haven't heard about, you know, AI finding something like new attack vector or something like this. Well, I do think it's reachable in certain, well, at a certain point. But there is definitely a lot of things that AI can facilitate and can do, even in terms of formal verification. So I have seen, I mean, apart from vulnerability detection, of course, generating summaries, I think was mentioned at some point during your podcast. And that is very good. One thing that I think AI can definitely do is, for example, check the documentation of the code, like NutSpec comments, and determine if the issue is there. Because I've seen this multiple times, and that was my very easy finding on Code Arena at some point. There was a comment saying, like, this should only be called by an owner, and guess what? It could be called by anyone. So matching this specification with what is being implemented is probably also something that should be doable for AI. How can it, you know, do this reasoning about the, you know, intricate, about the details of the operation of your like DeFi protocol or something like this? I don't think we're there yet in that sense. But yeah, as what I wanted to say about formal verification is that I have seen some work on combining AI with, for example, assisting SMT solvers or doing this automated reasoning in general. So that might be one of the ways in which the scalability problems are going to be addressed.
I think, well, you've also think of it like the AI is going to learn off something to begin with. Oh, actually, do they? To be fair, I don't know anything about AI, so this could just be like blabbering. But I mean, you would have to have something to kind of recognize what is correct and what's not. But I guess that's just a for loop in that sense, which in terms is just like fuzzing, really. It's just a feedback loop. But then it also learns of that long term instead of just running it once and not kind of learning off the past. I think that's the advantage of it. It actually learns from different, instead of just in like one context, it will learn from, you know, like a previous run of a different contract you did like last week, for example. It would learn off that one and, you know, introduce that into the new kind of context of this contract today. Whereas a fuzzer would only be able to learn off that contract in that specific time and then have to reset. So the resetting is the major flaw, I think, in like fuzzing in general, which is why AI is so powerful.
True. Well, I mean, in a fuzzer, you can probably store this information you have learned somewhere. like this corpus that you have generated, but whether it's being done, I'm not sure. But yes, I do agree with you. I think you're right when you say that it has to learn from something. That's why I'm a bit skeptical about having these AI tools identifying new attack vectors, because I do assume, from my limited knowledge as well, I think I'm like a third author on one paper about AI, but that was face recognition and a few years ago. So I don't think that I don't qualify as an expert for sure. But yeah, I have the same impression. The question is whether AI, I guess, is going to be like powerful enough to just use this information that it had learned about previous smart contract hacks in order to identify new ones. Or is going it should be like a very well-formulated problem that is going to be, you know, solvable in this way without this very detailed execution, let's say.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to, you know, does this path make money or get you one step closer to making money? I guess it's really just like the heuristic thing as well. Okay, you have this function that withdraws money. Is it, how do I get to that function? And then, yeah, is there any kind of conditions that I have to meet, et cetera, to get to that point? But I guess in that sense, if you already know all that information, may as well just do a heuristic then, right?
I guess that is true, but I'm not sure how far. I'm actually wondering how far you can get at the moment by just defining the problem like this.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we haven't seen it yet, but...
Well, maybe we just don't know that we've seen it yet. But as for this problem being formulated in a good way, I guess that's a common... So whenever, if you're talking about exploit generation or vulnerability detection, it always boils down to how you define the specifications you're checking. Because whether you do fuzzing and symbolic execution, and honestly, I think that there is some like educational work we have to do on this front. Like, and me personally, I should also improve. All this analysis, like program analysis, is going to be as good as the specifications are. If you're verifying the wrong thing, then... it doesn't really matter that much. So that's something I actually would, you know, would like to contribute to. I think there are some like sets of properties, the reusable ones. I think we have some at runtime verification. Trail of Bits also had, I think, released a good set of properties, predefined ones for some ERC20, some other tokens, and I think some mathematical library. So in general, that's very good. I value that a lot. I think it's a good contribution to the community. But in general, I think as all these tools develop, which is what our team and a lot of other teams are focusing on, we should also be aiming towards having, you know, better specifications that make the analysis reasonable. And that would also help if we are using AI tools, because I'm pretty sure that we also have to formulate it properly there as well.
Yeah, yeah. It all comes down to how well can you specify or define, you know, constraints, possibilities, what determines a possibility and a pathway, you know, to get to a certain point. So yeah, it's really limited to your understanding, actually. But, you know, an AI can learn over time better than like a human can in that terms, I think. But I think it would be interesting to see how it all plays out. I'm personally terrified of losing my job, so it's only a matter of time. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess we'll see. I'm relatively excited for good things that can do for me and for verification in general, bug finding as well. But yeah, I guess we should be safe for some time at least. So let's make a good use of this time.
Yeah, make your money now before you fall. But yeah, I think this marks the end of this podcast. I would like to thank you for coming on, Alina.
Yeah, thank you.
Quite good to talk about this stuff. Not many people are out there that are doing the things we're doing. And so it's great to finally like have a good discussion about all these topics. And I'm sure in the future we'll have another one to like kind of expand after we've upgraded a bit.
Yeah, sure. Would love to do this again. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, had a great conversation with you. Thanks.
Likewise. And for anyone listening, if you would like to jump on or suggest someone to jump on the podcast, just DM me at scrapingbits on Twitter or email me at scrapingbits@gmail.com. I'll get back to you otherwise. Thank you so much, Alina, for coming on. And I'll see you all in the next episode.
Thank you very much, too.